With a booming tech industry that has captured the imagination of the entire continent, Berlin has not only attracted people from all over Germany, but it's become a new home for thousands of expat coders, programmers, developers, creative minds. City statistics say there are around 500,000 non-Germans living in Berlin, and that's not including the diverse backgrounds of many German citizens who also have settled here. But beyond the numbers, what of the experience of the expat coder in Berlin? What pulled them in? What keeps them? And what surprises have they encountered along the way? How does this environment factor into the work that they do? Today, we examine the expat experience with the help of two talented individuals from the land of Nokia and long winters, Henry Bergius, and from the land of chocolate, watches, and small knives, Luc Delow. From Wikimedia Deutschland, I'm Mark Fonseca Renderu, and this is Source Code Berlin. My first guest today is Henry Bergius, an open source developer based in Berlin. As Henry can explain, there was a time where things back home in Finland were changing, a change that inspired him to set off in search of a new place to call home.
Yeah, so, I spent quite a lot of time traveling. Typical year, it's going to be 160, 180 days a year that I'm spending on the road. Mm-hmm. And so in that sense, it doesn't really matter where I live, as long as it's someplace fun. And most of my life I've lived in Helsinki, Finland, with short stints in St. Petersburg, Istanbul. And there was this time when, first of all, there was the collapse of Nokia. And then we had elections where this anti-immigration party had a landslide victory. And then my girlfriend graduated from the university. So that was kind of a good time to look where we want to live. Mm. And essentially we made a decision of just moving out of Finland and then started kind of shopping around for an interesting place to go. Finland, it's not a bad place to do things, but it's pretty far from everywhere. And it's starting to have this closed off mentality that, you know, economic hard times usually bring. Mm. And going to a conference, I would always have this few hundred euro and couple hours penalty of living in Finland in the far corner of Europe. And so we started looking around in Europe. Basically, the short list was Zurich, Amsterdam, London, and Berlin. Yeah, then there was the desktop summit here in Berlin, and I had the opportunity to familiarize myself with things like Cbase, generally the hacker scene here, and Berlin just clicked. Cost of living, the software community here, generally the quality of life and nightlife, all of that kind of worked. And I like the fact that now I can, if I need to go to a conference in Europe, I can just take a train. Once you've spent a long day programming, what do you do in the evening? Berlin provides a lot of opportunities. I've been kind of making my living off building open source software for the last 15 years. And so I obviously had my projects and my interests and my own customers. So it was mostly just continuation of that. But for a lot of that, Berlin is simply just an easier place to do these things from.
The question that even now, 3 episodes into this series, I probably ask too often, and people will soon start throwing things at their phones or laptops begging me to stop, but I'm going to ask it. The choice of doing open source software development, why does it appeal to you?
Well, when I started out in mid-90s, I mean, open source wasn't really a thing back then yet, but there was quite a lot of this free software stuff happening around. And I think I just kind of got caught up in the hype back then. And it just just kind of made sense that since all these tools that I'm using to build the things I build, to learn more, they are all open source. You know, why not make myself part of that ecosystem? Being able to build on top of things other people have built, and to learn from other people, for other people to learn from the things you do, the mistakes you do. That's obviously a big part of pushing humanity forward. And on that level, it definitely does make sense. But when I got started, I don't think I knew enough of the different options to really make that conscious decision. This is more like post-rationalization. But it all makes sense, and so I've kept doing these things. And for instance, in our current company, we have a very clear open source policy that everybody signs when they get on board, and where we already set the guidelines of what things definitely should be open source and what things are kind of in the area where we should discuss whether we open them or not. And the idea there is, because we all produce a lot of software every day in our work, you know, we don't have to have these management level discussions on, okay, this new library that I happen to make, should it be open source or not? You know, I can just look at where it sits in within our policy and just push it out there. No questions asked. Libraries or components in the flow-based programming terminology, they usually should be open, because they are just building blocks. They usually don't imply that much of kind of business logic. They are just tools for doing a job. But then when you build applications or graphs in NoFlow lingo, that's where, you know, you start combining these different libraries together, and that's where you, you know, build something unique for a particular purpose. And that's more the area where maybe, you know, first of all, maybe you want to keep some secret sauce, but secondly, maybe that's not so useful as open source either, because it's a combination of different libraries built for a particular purpose, which other people might not have. So that way we generally keep the building blocks in the open, but then the way to put these building blocks together might be kept closed.
You are the author of NoFlow, a JavaScript implementation of flow-based programming. And for those of us who don't know right away what that is, introduce us to it.
Software is a complex beast. We end up building these monsters that, you know, you have a lot of different pieces of functionality, little pieces of code that all need to talk to each other. And it usually becomes a very, very problematic thing to keep track of. If you make a change in this part of your source code, what things does that change affect? And so flow-based programming, which already comes from the 60s, is a way of managing that complexity. The idea is simply that you can abstract particular pieces of functionality in these black boxes called components, which have input ports, so they can receive data, and then they have output ports where they can send data. And then you build bigger units of software, full applications, by doing these graphs where you connect inputs of certain components with outputs of other components. And that way you can see how the data flows in your software, how the different parts of your software are connected. And NoFlow is an implementation of this flow-based programming ideology for JavaScript. It runs on different platforms. There's Node.js, obviously, for the server programming. Then there is a browser version, so you can build web applications. And then we also now have a version for the GNOME desktop, so you can actually build traditional desktop applications the same way, basically just by putting boxes on your graph and then connecting them together in a particular way. But there are other flow-based programming runtimes that are compatible with this idea. There's one called MicroFlow, which is for microcontroller programming. And then there is ImageFlow for image processing, built on the Gegel library that GIMP uses. And then there's a bunch of others, Java, Go, Python, all these different programming languages are pretty much covered. And the microflow part is where this kind of becomes fun, because that's where you can bring software to the real world. For instance, one of the guys in our team had an old fridge built in East Germany in the 70s, which broke. And, you know, normally you would probably throw it away, right? But since we had these tools, he took a Arduino and wired some things to that, and then programmed a new version of the fridge using these flow-based programming tools. And now what he has basically is a internet-connected fridge built in East Germany in the 70s. And he built, using our tools, he was able to build software that basically gives him cold beer.
Everything I've read and heard from you indicates that you're interested in connecting the world of open source software with the world of everyday jobs. Two things that haven't been paired together that often until now.
There's much more to the world of software than just MP3 players and web browsers. We need to be able to solve actual real world problems. And some of those might be related to, you know, particular areas of business or research, or they might also be just enabling different devices to talk with each other over the internet. And that's obviously something where open source ought to play a big role. Right now we are in this interesting situation where the open source ideology kind of won. Pretty much all the software in the world is built on top of open source libraries. But unfortunately, the free software or the software freedom aspect didn't win. So even though we won, we didn't really gain the things we thought to gain. Basically, software development is more efficient because of open source, but the users of software don't have any more freedom than they used to have. And that's why we need these kind of tools that allow easier kind of higher level abstraction. And that's where I see NoFlow and the other flow-based programming tools kind of sitting in, where you can look at a piece of software and you can see visually how things are connected. And this should allow a wider range of people to go and mess around with things, you know, reconfigure an application, connect it to new things. And that's maybe where we can start actually solving more the end-user problems than just the software development problems that we've been solving so far.
Let's get into another game-changing project of yours, the newest one, in fact. What is The Grid, other than a good title for another Hollywood movie about the internet with Sandra Bullock?
A week ago, we launched The Grid for pre-orders. It's essentially a machine that designs websites for you. So you just provide content and you tell the machinery, the kind of designer AI that lives within the machine, what you want to achieve with your website. And our machinery then puts all of this together and produces these beautiful, responsive websites out of it. You know, I'm sick and tired of these vanity metrics that people keep touting, like, ooh, our Facebook page has gazillion million likes. What does that mean? In the end, you need to bring the purpose of your web presence to the real world. Maybe you want to sell things, or maybe you just want people to listen to your music or read your things. But these are the real kind of goals your web presence has. And when you publish something on The Grid, we ask you, okay, what's the purpose of this? And then we optimize the whole web presence for that purpose. We track it against that purpose. We try different things automatically, and we will automatically change your site to fit the purpose better. The thing is, on Facebook, there's only one metric. It's a like, which doesn't really mean anything. Here we can actually, we tie the purposes of the website to actual real world actions. Like, okay, if you want people to listen to your music, then we can track how many people click the play button, how many people actually listen to the song to the end. And then we know how well your site is performing. And on the side, because usually our engine can produce multiple different websites for the same content, we can actually try multiple things at the same time. Like, okay, 60% of people going to your website gets this version because we initially think this is the best one. But then we try these other versions on the side. And if they actually get people to listen more to your music, then, you know, they start bubbling up more. So we do this kind of automated A/B testing. But yeah, it's kind of a long story how we came to this. And this totally ties into my kind of early steps into the open source world. 20 years ago, I started with a bunch of friends this historical reenactment association in Finland. And eventually, you know, we were publishing a magazine and we were publishing a lot of papers and photos from our events and all that stuff. And putting those on the web started becoming a bit cumbersome. You know, we were sick and tired of just writing HTML. And so we ended up experimenting with building these web publishing tools back in mid-90s. And we stumbled on creating this thing we called Midgard, which initially we thought, okay, you know, this is going to be something temporary. You know, somebody's going to solve this website problem soon, for real. But as it happens, you know, Midgard is still around. There's all these other tools, hundreds of different CMSs, WordPress, Drupal, Tumblr, whatever, different ways for people to get a website. But none of them are really that good. You know, the only web publishing tool that people really, really end up using is basically Facebook. And that's not the real web. That's just behind the walled garden, you know, conforming to the uniformal identity that Facebook imposes on you. You are not owning your audience. You are not owning your identity. And so we want to bring this back. We want to have the same kind of ease of use that, you know, posting to Facebook or Twitter has. But at the same time, in a web property that you control, your domain, your content, your own place on the internet. And that's essentially what we're trying to achieve here.
Now, staying on that theme, what about this phenomenon, this reality in the world today, where a huge percentage of people on the internet don't even notice that something is wrong with doing everything via Facebook? People who don't even know why they would want alternatives.
We get a lot of that. You know, people already have Facebook, they already have Twitter, they have Tumblr. And, you know, besides, isn't the web dead? You know, everybody wants apps now. I don't agree with any of that. I think the web is still the only kind of significant communications innovation made in the last 20, 30 years. It's the only way where we can have this network where everybody can have a voice, everybody can have their own space, and everybody can read and access. And big part of this is also the question of identity and privacy. You know, on Facebook you have that one identity, whereas on the web you can have multiple websites. You know, you can have your hobbies as their own websites. You can have your profession or even multiple professions as their own websites. You can have the associations you participate in, the open source projects. All of these can be their own identities. And there doesn't necessarily have to be any way to link between these. So, you know, you can express things more freely when your identities are not connected with each other. And I think that's going to resonate pretty well with the audiences. And the other part, obviously, is, you know, the kind of sharecropping, or essentially being a serf when you live on somebody else's platform. Facebook demonstrated this pretty well recently when they basically killed the organic reach of Facebook pages. Originally, people who had Facebook pages, they built up an audience of people liking it because they knew, okay, if they post something on the page, these people will see it in their newsfeed. And Facebook has been turning down the dial on that one. So basically now the only way to reach these people that you worked so hard to build as your audience is to pay Facebook to do so. And you know, if it was a website on your own control, this kind of stuff wouldn't happen.
But what if you're a serf on someone else's land? For all intents and purposes, you're a slave, but you somehow don't know it.
Yeah, and this is obviously the next challenge. First, we need to get the platform out there. The grid.io is now in pre-orders, and we'll do the public launch in spring. And then, once it's out there, we obviously have to do all the big work of making people aware of the possibilities and the limitations in the other platforms. Getting the word out is going to be a big job. Yeah. But we will be able to kind of let people reclaim the web, you know, let millions of domains bloom instead of, you know, just facebook.com.
You've made use of Kickstarter to fund your development. How do you see Kickstarter in terms of being a viable option for funding work like this? And what did you learn about your audience while doing the campaign?
We did the Kickstarter for the kind of IDE for flow-based programming last year. And that went pretty well. We got a lot of media attention. And at that time, it was, I think, the fifth largest software Kickstarter ever. So that was really, really a nice measure of success. And definitely, I think crowdfunding is a good way to push open source projects forward, but now we are doing the same with the Grid crowdfunder, where it's more of a pre-order campaign because the product is already almost there, and now we are just kind of building momentum on getting it on the road. But with the NoFlow crowdfunder, I think the bigger impact than the money actually was generally kind of raising awareness in flow-based programming. There were a lot of people who had never heard of the concept and only heard of it because of the crowdfunding campaign and all the press around it. And that brought a lot of interesting possibilities. Like, for instance, this Microflow thing came to be because of our crowdfunder. You know, we were only talking about JavaScript back then. And now, when we delivered our Kickstarter in September, you could not only do JavaScript development with our tools, but also do native Android, Python, microcontroller, a lot of different things that we hadn't even thought about and that other people in the community brought in because of the crowdfunding success. So that's definitely something to recommend, but also something to kind of give a word of warning about this. Doing a crowdfunding campaign is a lot of work. You have to produce a good video, design the rewards. You have to do a lot of work with the press to get the visibility out. And then, of course, delivering the rewards, like even if you're just giving T-shirts, it's not, you know, cheap to send them all around the world. So in the end, the crowdfunding campaign might be a lot more work than you expect and might give a lot less money than you expect. But as it also gives you publicity, probably gives you more people in your community, I think it's definitely, at least for NoFlow, it was a net positive. And it really feels good to have delivered on our promises.
Yeah. What do you learn about your audience when you look at what's happening with your crowdfunding? You can always see some information.
Yeah, I don't know. That's kind of a hard question. I mean, with when we did the NoFlow one, we thought we would be more reaching out just to open source developers, but it ended up that we had a lot of people from kind of more educational background who were interested in this because they saw NoFlow as a very good tool for teaching programming. There were a lot of people from the business world who wanted to leverage this for, you know, automating parts of their business environment. I mean, that's essentially what we're doing with the grid. Everything there, the pre-order system, the payment system that accepts Bitcoin and credit card, all of that is Noflow. The whole engine, the whole AI that designs these websites for you, that's all Noflow. That's all flow-based. And I mean, definitely interacting with the community during the campaign and after the campaign has kind of opened our own eyes also to the to the possibilities. Because usually when you build a tool, you build it with a certain purpose in mind. You know, this is, I have a problem, I need to solve that problem, I build a tool to solve that problem. But then when other people see your tool, they might realize different uses for it. And you might realize that actually those uses are even more valuable than the one you originally had in mind. I think crowdfunding is definitely, even for like end user products, not just software, I think it's a valuable way to kind of get the direct contact with your potential early adopters and kind of build this community. So that's something like, I would find it hard to launch something without some sort of a pre-order crowdfunding, some sort of a early access campaign, because that gives you a lot better view on how people perceive your product, how they interact with it, and how things should be communicated. It's kind of crowdfunding for a product is very similar as, you know, in the old days, beta was for software.
Finally today, you've been here for a couple of years. You've got projects and experiences under your belt. How does Henry Bergius, who first came to live in Berlin, compare to the Henry Bergius of 2014?
Yeah, so, I mean, obviously, arriving to Berlin, we knew some people here, we knew some of the communities, but there's always the step of kind of cultural integration of, you know, starting to make this place feel home. And for me personally, there's been two big factors that made Berlin home. One of them obviously was Seabase, all the craziness, all these late night conversations and interesting events and building things together with other people. That's a big deal. But the other part, interestingly, was this augmented reality game called Ingress, where it's basically a global game of capture the flag, where people walk around their home cities or other places with the phone in hand and with GPS and capture these portals and have these epic battles over the future of humanity. And Ingress came out like about a year after we moved here, and definitely was a big impact, because first of all, a lot of Ingress is a very social game, because you have to, it's a computer game, you have to play in the city. The whole world is your playing board. And so people tend to meet while they are playing. You suddenly have 20 people trying to capture someplace in Alexanderplatz, and you start looking around you and you see other people with phones, and then you go and introduce yourself and you end up having a beer. And because the game map is the city, yeah, you end up knowing Berlin very well. You know, I've walked around the Ringbahn, I've been pretty much everywhere in the city, and that definitely helps this thing to feel like home.
Henry Bergius is a hacker and occasional adventurer. He's the author of Create.js and Noflow. You can follow his work at bergi.iki.fe. That's B-E-R-G-I-E. move on now from the story of someone moving from one corner of Europe to a more center point, being Berlin, to the story of someone from another German-speaking nation who came to Berlin to work with a large and well-established company in the world of open source, which many of you will recognize. Luc Delot is a Swiss resident of Berlin for the past 2.5 years. He's also a senior Linux consultant at Red Hat. And above all, he's a curious and talented person who somehow found his way to life in Berlin. An adventure that began, as he describes it, with an opportunity.
It was an opportunity. And yeah, I give it a try. And it was probably one of my best decisions in my life. I was working at different companies, mostly IT outsourcing companies, and I was a little bit bored about this. And so I got contacted from my employer, from today's employer, if I want to move to Germany and working for them. And then I had a choice of different German cities, and one of them was Berlin. And yeah, it was just a quick decision to do so, give it a try, to see how it works out.
Let's talk about your first experiences with Linux, which I gather happened some time ago.
It was in 1994, so I was about 22. And it was just something amazing. With at that time back a strange license, everyone was allowed to use it, to alter it, working together with other people, asking other people about it, basically to share.
Fast forward all these years later, Linux has become, it seems, quite widely used.
Actually, there is no big company on this planet which is not using any Linux. So you will find Linux in every bigger company. It worked out to be logical because Linux is also very portable. It's scalable from, let's say, smartwatches to the mainframe. I think this was a logical consequence.
Moving from Switzerland to Germany, it's not far, but it is a different country. And was that a difficult move?
So I was a little bit afraid of German bureaucracy, but this turned out to be wrong. So it was just easy as going to the government office and say, hello, here I am, and all was settled from that point. So my mother tongue is German, but actually it's so similar. The culture of the Germans and the Swiss is quite close. And language-wise, there are some let's say, words that are not used in Germany, stuff like that. So people still figure out that I'm Swiss as soon as I'm talking to them. That's quite amazing.
How did your relationship with Red Hat begin?
In the last company where I was working, I used to work with a lot of Red Hat products. And yeah, so I have already known some people at Red Hat. I was also joining some Fedora conferences where I also met some Red Hat and Fedora guys. And then I was approached by them if I would like to join, and then we started some job interviews and finally got the contract. There is a joke going around that Red Hat is the oldest and largest startup company. So it's still a culture of openness, not that much of processes, just the processes that are needed to do the job. But it's quite similar to startup companies. So basically, Red Hat is selling subscriptions, software subscriptions, for getting support and updates. And so this money is then being used to develop software. And open source software, not just software.
Talk about the effect of the move that Red Hat initiated not too long ago towards the cloud. And if you look around, does anything surprise you in terms of the direction that Linux is going and the way it's being used in the world?
Well, of course, it affects me because we have new products which are already on the market or will be emerge to markets. And well, it's interesting. And of course, all those cloud products, the base of it is still an operating system. And this is basically a Linux system. Linux is so spreaded on the globe. There is actually nothing that can surprise me anymore. In Malaysia, there was a huge e-learning project. This was quite interesting, and it was all virtualized. And of course, it needs some system management software. We have been there with some consultants to help the customer to implement all these things.
I asked this to our previous guest. It's my go-to question. Open source, is it a conscious mission out of principle, or is it just practical?
Well, it's actually, from my point of view, it's a combination of both. You cannot having a dogma of a philosophy, but on the other hand, it's business. And I think it's a very successful business. And it also gives people the chance to learn about this software without paying. As an example, if you want to learn Windows Server Enterprise Edition, you cannot just get it for free and try it, learn by yourself. You need to buy the product, and it has quite a hefty price tag.
Okay, here's one for you. Most interesting place your work has ever taken you?
Last year I was in Uganda. I was actually surprised that there are, let's say, companies using Linux. Yeah, you have just a limited amount of companies that will be using IT systems at all, because it's a lot of handicraft and stuff like that. But there are some companies using Linux as well.
Looking to the future, Luke, will we find you here in a few years? Does your experience make you want to continue as a Berliner?
Well, I think I will stay in Berlin at least for another few years, because it's a friendly place, and I can find whatever I like. So different cultural stuff of any kind. You have a lot of restaurants with food from all over the planet. You have a lot of nice bars, a lot of shops where you can buy all the stuff needed without having a car. Public transportation is brilliant. A lot of things that I really like in Berlin.
Well, Luke Deloe, thanks for sharing your experience, and we wish you all the best.
It's a pleasure.
There you have it. Two expat experiences, two different daily working experiences and styles of settling in this unique place. Despite their different interests, they share that common interest in cultivating fun and experiences that matter when they're not working. And in the end, while work is a big pull factor for many people who settle here, it's the stuff outside of work that you so often hear about, that people seem to look forward to, and it's the stuff that might end up keeping you here. That does it for this edition of Source Code Berlin. Thanks to all those who have emailed and commented on the program via the website or Twitter, Facebook. Source Code Berlin is a Wikimedia Deutschland podcast. You can find us at sourcecode.berlin or follow us on Facebook, Source Code Berlin, on Twitter at SRC Code Berlin. Music featured on today's program was by the Underscore Orchestra. This podcast is published under a CC BY SA 4.0 license and edited by me. Until next time, I'm Mark Fonseca Renderu. Thanks for listening.